We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Craig is usually a fan of water cooler talk, but it's draft season, and that's all anyone wants to talk about. The Athletic has loads of articles about this year's draft. But Greg doesn't have The Athletic, so now he's filling up his water bottle in the bathroom sink. Which, to remind you, is the sink people use after they use the bathroom. Get The Athletic and get the info you need to speak draft fluently.
From brand new Pod World Headquarters, this is the Carolina Insider from Learfield IMG College.
We're back. Time for another edition of the Carolina Insider. Jones and Adam here with you. Adam, how are the Bahamas? Are they lovely?
The weather's much better than it was there in Chapel Hill. I remember that weather on Saturday when it was a little cold and rainy. Here in the Bahamas, Jones, it's warmer. It's in the upper 70s to the low 80s. It is mostly sunny almost all the time, except when it's completely sunny, and everyone is very pleasant, and things are expensive.
All right, thanks for joining us here on the Carolina Insider. No, Adam is, Adam, as you are hearing this, Adam is actually in the Bahamas, but we are recording this a little earlier than normal because of Adam's travel schedule. He's down in the Bahamas with Dave Nathan, Eric Montross, for basketball coverage on the Tar Heel Sports Network. I am remaining here for football coverage on the network. And so we have our crew split in two, and we're going to get all the Tar Heel action to you coming up over the next several days. Because of that, a couple different things. Adam and I are going to talk about the Mercer win, and it was quite a win for the Tar Heels, 56-7. And, I mean, the Tar Heels played pretty much everybody on the roster. They only threw two passes in the entire second half. So 56-7 probably wasn't even representative of how much Carolina controlled that game. We're going to talk about it. We will preview the games down in the Bahamas. We will also get you Mac Brown audio from his Monday press conference so you can hear at least some of what Coach Brown has to say, because normally on our Tuesday pods, we like to bring you some comments about Coach Brown and his thoughts on the game and the next opponent and all those kind of things. But since we're recording a little earlier, we'll let you listen to Coach Brown and some of his comments from his Monday press conference. And a great guest, Adam, the return of Freddie Kiger here on the Carolina Insider.
Much requested, highly sought after. When we had Freddie Kiger on for his first full-length interview, he's actually been on twice, but one full-length interview, this being his second. We said there are lots of Freddie Kiger topics that we weren't even able to cover in this one, and we would like to have him back. Well, that's happening today. Yeah. And we wanted to know what that was like teaching Jeff Denny how to swim.
Yeah, most importantly. So we talked to Freddie. You're going to enjoy that. Freddie is one of those people that could read the phone book, and you would just be enthralled, because that's just the type of orator that he is, Adam. So look forward to talking to Freddie here coming up in a little bit. But before we do that, will you please get that music started? Because we're brought to you by the Pinehurst Resort. Experience the cradle a 789-yard short course that our friends at the Golf Channel call the most fun 10 acres in all of golf. Visit Pinehurst.com to plan your next golf getaway. Adam, I see you gazing at the Carolina Insider giant board that we have here in brand new Pod World headquarters. You just soaking in that logo?
We're up to double figure signatures now.
Yeah, we're trying to catch up on all 3 years previous. I don't think I'm going to go out on a limb and say it's going to be hard to get every single person we've ever had to sign the board. But anytime we get the chance to get a former guest to come in and sign the board, we do it. Our good friend Joel Curran, the latest to sign the board retroactively from his appearance. So looking forward to getting more signatures on that board, including Freddie Kigers, who's already up there, our guest today.
I noticed when we posted a picture of Jeff Denny signing on Friday, if your eagle eyes look at some of the pictures we post, you might be able to tell who some future guests might be. I didn't even think of that until I was looking at it.
All right, Adam, let's go back to Saturday night afternoon / evening in Keenan Stadium. Carolina Mercer, and we said this in the preview of the game, Carolina is better than Mercer. And Mack Brown harped on the fact all week that the most important thing in his mind was that he wanted his team to be prepared, he wanted his team to execute, he wanted his team to play as if this was any game. He wanted them to do all the same things that they did on any single week. Even in the pregame conversation on the Target Sports Network that Coach and I had, I asked him about the fact that he had the team this week watch film of the Western Carolina game from a year ago. Carolina won that game by 23. I think it was 49-26 or 49-23, something like that. But the Tar Heels gave up more than 400 yards. They turned it over three times. They trailed early in that game. Talking about Western Carolina last year. I asked Coach why he did that, and he said because he didn't feel like the team was very ready to play, very energetic, and that they won because they had more talent. And he didn't want to just win because they had more talent. And Adam, I thought, for what this game was, it was a perfect night for Carolina. They played well. They jumped on Mercer early. They were able to play a lot of guys. They got some seniors and some guys who haven't had, you know, big moments necessarily this year. They allowed those guys to have some individual big moments. Nobody got hurt, as far as I know. So for as good as it can be in a game against an FCS opponent for your fifth win in the year, I think that's what it was for the Tar Heels on Saturday.
And he said it right after the game with you when he said this was a home run for us and everything we wanted coming into this one we got. I think that pretty much sums it up. I don't know why I felt this way. Maybe it's because he talks so eloquently about it as usual. It felt like this was a good senior day that everyone seemed to understand the importance of, and he talked with you about how he felt like all the non-seniors really understood how important senior day was for the seniors, and the seniors really appreciated that it was their senior day and soaked it all in. And I guess that's what you can do when it's 56-7 and it's 28-0 in the first couple minutes. But it just felt like a good, productive senior day that everybody was able to be a part of in some form or fashion, and that meant something to the seniors who were involved in it.
To that point, we talked to Charlie Heck in the post game, one of the seniors for Carolina. And one of the things that he talked about making it an enjoyable senior day was then seeing the younger guys going out there and playing well after his time during this game was done. And a little bit of, this is what's coming later. And he talked a lot about and was really good in talking about, yes, there's been some disappointing finishes this year, but how excited he was to be part of the group that very clearly had Carolina back in better standing and getting closer to where it wanted to be. And again, a win over Mercer isn't the measuring stick for Carolina, but I think this is just, I do think it's a step in the right direction because, and Brian talked about this, Brian Simmons talked about this in pregame, and Mac talked about, Coach Brown talked about this some too. Good teams do exactly what Carolina did in this game. They leave no doubt. They dominate early. They don't let the other team hang around. They don't play sloppy football. And Carolina did all of those things that you would want it to do.
Yeah, if you had made a checklist that you wanted to do this, this, and this, every single box would have been checked. The defense got some turnovers and almost had that first shutout since 2012. Yep. Until those final minutes against third and fourth stringers. Would have loved to have gotten that shutout. But other than that, you got everything you needed. And as you said, and as Coach Brown talked about after the game and everybody talked about, nobody got hurt.
Yeah.
And those who needed another week to get a little stronger, got a little stronger. And you can go over to Raleigh about as close to full strength as you have been in the last 3 or 4 or 5 weeks.
Tar Heels, not a big surprise, rushed the ball very effectively. We talked about Mercer's struggles stopping the run. They were next to last in the nation at the FCS level in stopping the run. Carolina rushed for 376 yards in the game. Michael Carter had 9 carries for 159 yards. He averaged almost 18 yards per carry. Had 3 touchdowns, had 2 really long scores, one of 45 and one of 60. Antonio Williams got a touchdown, 66 yards on 65 total yards in 9 carries. Josh Henderson had 13 carries for 98 yards. He's a freshman. I thought he looked good running hard near the end of the game. A freshman who will still be able to redshirt this year because that was his first action, I believe. Actually, Josh may have played more on special teams. Have to double check that. But a young guy who got in for the first time getting carries and played well. Javonte Williams, not a lot of usage from him today, but again, he's been a little shaken up. So just 6 carries, 27 yards. British Brooks got in the end zone. Touchdowns for Deami Brown and Jake Bargus and Emory Simmons. Great catch by Emory Simmons on his touchdown. And Adam, also Sam Howell, 10 of 13, 152 yards, 3 touchdowns, only played the first half. He has 32 touchdowns now, and I know that we have beaten this drum a bunch. That's the most ever in a single season for Carolina football. It's the second most ever for a freshman in ACC history and the most ever at the FBS level for a true freshman. The difference in those two things that I just told you is Jameis Winston holds the ACC record for a freshman with 40 touchdown passes, but he was a redshirt freshman. Sam being a true freshman. Adam, I mean, those are – I know you can sometimes we can throw all these numbers and stats and they can get a little they dull your mind a little bit. Those are impressive numbers. I mean, most ever in a single season for Carolina. Second most ever for any freshman in the conference. First most or the most ever for a true freshman at FBS level. Those are big deals. And man, what a season for him that continues to go well.
The only way I know to quantify the season he's had is look at the names ahead of him on the ACC single season touchdown list. Some of these guys are on there more than once, but these are the guys. Deshaun Watson, pretty good. Jameis Winston, yep. Phillip Rivers, Taj Boyd, Chris Winkie, Danny Cannell.
All great players at their position.
Those are the only people who in the ACC have thrown more touchdown passes than Sam Howell this year, and he's got another regular season game to go in which hopefully he will throw 14 touchdown passes against the Wolfpack, at least.
I'll tell you one thing that I thought was encouraging about this game, and again, it was against Mercer. Some of the reserves defensively, you could see what was there. Like Vohasek, I thought played great, and he's going to be maybe a starter next year on the D-line. Those two young linebackers, Kadri Jackson and Eugene Asante, they didn't always make the play, but they were flying around in the area almost all the time, and sometimes they were out of control a little bit. But you could see the physical part of what they had. I thought that, you know, Don Chapman, a true freshman, knocks away or forces the fumble on the first play of the game. Carolina really likes him. They feel like they've got something there for the future. So just some young guys that I thought were really active. And again, it's a relative term with where the game was and who the opponent was. But I thought you saw some exciting stuff for guys who will play bigger roles later on in their careers.
And the key thing is that the physical part is there. Now, they had the advantage in that the mental part, they weren't as worried about getting beaten because they felt like they could probably make up any physical error with their superior talents and gifts. So maybe you're able to go 5% harder because you're not as worried about somebody slipping behind you and you give up a big play. Oh, I just cost my team the game. So you don't have to worry about that. But physically, they're capable. And defense is an area where Carolina is going to lose quite a bit off of this year's team. And so encouraging for next year because the start of next year's season is going to be very difficult.
By the way, Chaz Surratt, 5 tackles. He could have had 500 tackles in this game. He maybe played 3 series defensively. It wasn't much, and he was all over the place.
He made one play on the Carolina sideline where Mercer was running towards the sideline, and he was on the opposite side of the field, and he just came tearing across the field from sideline to sideline, and I looked up and thought, who in the world was that? And it was Chaz Surratt. He's made a ton of plays like that this year.
Jay Bateman, Carolina's defensive coordinator, said this week he had a very frank conversation with Surratt after the Pitt game, basically saying he didn't think he played very well and that he's had a great year, but there's still a lot he needs to learn and that he wanted him to tighten it up a little bit. And he looked great in the limited duty that he had against Mercer this past Saturday. Adam, anything else I'm missing here from the Mercer game? It was neat to get all kinds of guys in there. Great to see Bargus get a touchdown as a senior. Kamari Morales, a young freshman tight end, made a really nice catch late in the game for Carolina. And so just, again, a lot of different guys getting involved, a lot of exciting things for some young players.
I think 3 quick things. I think, one, that game was good because Carolina was able to work on some stuff. Like one of the drives in the first half, they were able to go really quick tempo, which at times they have not been very good at this year. But, again, it was Mercer. But you're able to do it and drill it in a game situation. You might need that next week in Raleigh. You don't know. And now you've done it because, of course, that drive ended in yet another touchdown. Two kind of semi-off-the-field moments. Mac Brown, and you both mentioned one of them, which was when Sam Howell was announced on the video board as having broken Carolina's single-season touchdown record, and all his teammates kind of gathered around him, and of course Sam Howell was like, okay, guys, I'm excited.
No big deal, fellas.
And they were all jumping up and down and dancing around, and he was just kind of in the middle of it, but you could tell that they were happy for him, and he's not some big-shot guy who – they're happy to catch his passes, but they don't really like hanging around him. You could tell they were happy for him that he had done this amazing thing. I thought that was cool. And I thought it was cool that Torin Dorn was the Keenan legend and that when he was announced and walked out on the field, Miles Dorn was able to give him the big thumbs up and then came over and gave him a big hug.
There was Tar Heel family moment, Adam.
And then Mac Brown came over and gave Torin Dorn a hug.
You can do that when it's like 42-0 at that
exactly.
Point.
At that point, it was 28-0 in the second quarter. So everybody's just like looking for somebody to hug. Ah, come here. Torin Dorn, come give me a hug. You're a Keenan legend. But that was cool.
I know that it was not a full crowd. I still thought the people who were there were invested. They were into it because, you and I were both there. It was nasty. It was a nasty day. Upper 40s, low 50s, so just cold enough to make it gross. It rained almost the entire game. It had been raining since the morning in Chapel Hill, so it was a raw day. It got really foggy by the end of the game. I thought another thing, and Carolina's done this last couple years where they let fans out on the field in the last game, but Mac Brown did something different this year where he had all the players go out there. What a great idea that the players went out on the field and all of a sudden all these Tar Heel fans who stayed in an ugly day are all of a sudden they get a high five Michael Carter and take a selfie with De'Ami Brown or whatever it is. I thought that was a wise PR move by Mac Brown, who makes many.
And we've talked about this before, that we felt like Carolina should do something for the people who, for example, sat out at the Idaho game or sat out at the Virginia Tech game in the rain. I would put this game right in that same category because I know it said it was 50 or 51 or whatever. It was not. It was colder than that. So then you add in the rain. If you sat out in that game for 3+ hours to watch Carolina win a game that was never in doubt, then you never need your Tar Heel fan credentials questioned ever again, ever. And you deserve to take a selfie with Michael Carter and talk about Marvel movies.
Yeah. So, all in all, Adam, a feel-good day for the Tar Heels. Now, this is our only pod this week, so let's look ahead to NC State. Mm. The Pack lost on Thursday to Georgia Tech, so they cannot qualify for a bowl. They will be playing for Senior Day, their final game, and trying to keep Carolina from being bowl eligible. It will be a heated environment, an emotional game, and Carolina's going to have to play well to win. State has had trouble at the quarterback position. I believe they've started 3 different guys at the quarterback spot. They're starting a young guy now. I think it's Leary is his last name, is the starter at QB. the Pack has had a tough time defensively. And having said all of that, we all know none of that matters, that it's going to be a physical, emotional game, and Carolina's going to have to play well. Even though I think right now Carolina is a better team than NC State at this moment, we'll just have to wait and see.
I think Carolina is better on the field than NC State, and if they would just take off their Carolina and NC State uniforms and one team put on a white shirt and one team put on a black shirt, whichever one was Carolina would win. But that's not going to matter. And I would venture a guess that it will be chippy, and that Carolina's approach this year of trying to limit some of those silly penalties and some of the after the whistle stuff is going to be tested. And you can't afford to give a team that's not as good as you 15 extra yards once every two or three drives. So that's going to be important. I hope there's none of this. Why is it now something that happens that when teams come out to warm up, they got to start barking at each other when they get near the 50-yard line? That's so dumb. Ohio State and Penn State did it on Saturday. Look, teams have been playing big games and rivalry games for forever, and they don't need to go out there and show how big and tough they are when they're catching 12-yard outs with no defense. Nobody's impressed by that. Just do your warm-ups, stretch, listen to Brian Hess get you fired up. Go in the locker room and then come out and put 60 on the board. That's the toughest thing you can do.
Don't make John Bunning and Chuck Amato have to.
Now, that was good. I like that.
It's a 7 o'clock kick.
Oh, boy.
So the atmosphere will be alive.
Although they've had trouble with crowds at Carter-Finley, like in terms of quantity.
Yes.
I'm not talking about crowd control. That, too. If you're a Carolina fan in the Triangle area, it's your chance to go over there and buy tickets and make that place a little bluer.
Yeah, there were still a lot of seats available in one of the end zones in Carter-Finley for this game.
And that will matter to this team. This team feeds off of that kind of thing.
That's a big game. It always is a big game. And Adam, I do feel like we said this recently. The overall feel of the season is going to flip dramatically. And that doesn't mean if Carolina loses that you go, oh, what a terrible year, because that's not the case. But if you win this game and all of a sudden you beat Duke and State in the same year after having trouble with that recently, you qualify for a bowl, it is so much a better feel than if you lose. And again, if you lose, you can still see it. But if you win it, it is in your face.
If you win, you have the tangible example in your hand. When someone says, what progress did you make? You say, here, this, this, and this. If you lose, you know in your heart there was progress. But when somebody says, what progress did you make? You have to say, I can feel it in my heart. That's a little different.
Can't see it in here unless you have x-ray eyes. All right, let's get to our UNC Healthcare Champion of the Gridiron, where we highlight MVPs from the past game. It's brought to you by UNC Healthcare, dedicated to caring for champions of all kinds to help keep you in the game and at your very best. You can see their lineup at unchealthcare.org/sports. Adam, I think it's easy to highlight any one of many Tar Heels in this game. Certainly Michael Carter had the biggest game, 9 carries, 159 yards, and 3 touchdowns. I will also say, and I know I glossed over this for a second earlier, that catch by Emory Simmons, freshman in the end zone, he had a defender all over him. It was a beautiful throw by Howell, and I thought that was a big-time catch.
I almost felt bad for the defender. Yeah. Like, what else can you do? You played it absolutely perfectly, but the guy made a ridiculous NFL-type throw, and then the receiver, who's a freshman who you didn't think was going to do that, made a great catch. Nothing you can do. Sometimes that happens.
Can I also say a fun moment in the game was when Storm Duck intercepted the trick play, and the Tar Heels actually didn't want the interception to count because it cost them about 15 yards of field position. But we do know one gentleman that wanted it to count, and that was Storm Duck. And it was a great play.
He wasn't giving back that turnover belt.
No.
He went and stood up on the bench and put on his turnover belt, and he wanted his interception.
It was a great play. Knocked the pass up in the air with his front hand and then caught it, kept his feet in bounds. It really was a terrific interception by a Tar Heel freshman. Okay, Adam, would you like to preview the Bahamas before or after we talk to Freddie Kiger?
We can do it now.
Okay, so the Heels start off with Alabama. Adam, I think in a traditional year, you would like this matchup for the Tar Heels. Alabama likes to play at a high pace. They do turn the ball over a little bit. They will take some quick shots. And so I think, again, in a traditional year, you go, ooh, yeah, I like all that. That's what Tar Heels like, too. And normally they're better at it than when somebody tries to do it with them. I don't know, and it may still be that way. I just don't think we know enough about this team to know if they'll be able to consistently take advantage of that kind of style or not. But we'll find out soon.
If Carolina doesn't break 80 in this game, that is concerning. Because Alabama, as you said, wants to play extremely fast. Their average offensive possession length is about 14 seconds. That's in the top 10 fastest in the country. But they do turn it over a ton, which you would think would create some easy baskets. They take a lot of threes, which is a little worrisome. But they don't hit a whole lot of them. But you know who else didn't always hit a whole lot of them? Auburn. So Alabama's going to go to the offensive glass a pretty good amount. As we know, Carolina's going to want to, so two teams that want to do the same thing. It's an interesting game. I think Carolina's better than Alabama, I think, but we don't have a ton of evidence other than Alabama's lost a couple games. I think something you said on the last episode, it'll be interesting to see if this is the case, in that Carolina played its best against Notre Dame. Well, these are going to be more Notre Dame-type games than Gardner-Webb-type games. So do we see that version of the Tar Heels? And if so, maybe we'll know a little more than we thought we did about the Tar Heels a week from now.
Carolina, of course, is going to the Bahamas to try and win the tournament. It feels important to me, Adam, to at least get two in this tournament. And just with what is coming up, the caliber of competition, so just by default, if you won two, you would have beaten two pretty good teams. And again, they're going there to win. That's what they want to do. But I do feel like it would be important for Carolina to win two in this event, if possible.
And what you said about what's coming up, I think, is important, because it can snowball on you in a hurry. But if you come out of this week at least 2-1, then I think you can feel, okay, this is a stacked field. And Carolina's been in a few of those here lately, it seems like. But there are multiple NCAA tournament teams in this event.
So Alabama-Carolina is the first game for the Tar Heels. And then it will be either Michigan or Iowa State after that. The other half of the bracket highlighted by a couple of ranked teams, including Seton Hall, Oregon, and Gonzaga. Of course, the Tar Heels will already see Gonzaga in a couple of weeks in Spokane. That game on Wednesday is at 2:30. So we'll be on the air radio-wise Wednesday at 1:30. And then if the Tar Heels win, they play at 1:30 on Thursday. If they lose, they play at 6:30. On Thursday, again, against either Iowa State or Michigan, depending on who wins and loses that game. Adam, anything else Bahamas-wise, other than I will also mention, hope to see Brandon Robinson. I think he's really, really close. He was a game-time decision against Elon. Tar Heels elected just to hold him out a little bit longer to help him get healthier. I do think and hope you see Brandon Robinson here soon.
I was going to add that also. I think the mood that Roy Williams has been in lately has been a little frustrated with his team. And I think traditionally at these type of events, you hear lots about going down water slides and having going out snorkeling and all that kind of thing. I think the Tar Heels are going to have a couple tough practices in Nassau prior to that Alabama game.
Tomorrow, 2:30. Bahamas, be there. And it is a unique scenario. It's played in a ballroom. It's weird.
It's dark.
It's really dark. It's a unique camp. I don't know the capacity. It can't be more than 2,000 or 3,000 or something. So it is it's an odd scenario. Good teams. See how the Heels do. It's a big week for the Tar Heels, it feels like to me, and we'll see how they do. I think we're going to know a whole lot more about this team. And whatever we know, it's not going to be definitive, but I think we're going to know a whole lot more about this team right now when you get through this event. Okay, Freddie Kiger has joined us once. That was very early in the pod. If you have never heard the first conversation with Freddie, I strongly encourage you to go back and see if you can find it in the pod archives, because it is excellent. And this one is too. Let's get to our conversation here on the Carolina Insider with Freddie Kiger.
I know the perfect way to describe how good this next guest is.
I can't wait to hear it, Adam, because let me just say, this gentleman has joined us twice before and always one of our most popular guests here on the Carolina Insider. Always.
Here's all you need to know about Freddie Kiger. Freddie Kiger has won an Emmy. And yet, when we had him on, we have never yet talked about the fact that he won an Emmy.
Yeah. Have you won a potty yet, though, Freddie?
No.
Okay.
Well, I did when I was a kid.
Well, good news. You're up for one now. Every interview nominated for a potty.
Really? Is that what they're calling it?
Dick Bedore's won one.
That's what we're calling it.
Matt Doherty has won one. But you've got stiff competition this year.
Well, I am. I stand in the shadow of all those people. You guys are kind to ask me back. I appreciate
it. It took over 2 years to have Freddie back from his first big interview.
Yeah, for a full interview. We had Freddie as a part of our Woody Durham tribute episode as well. But since we had Freddie from the first time, had like a 90, maybe not quite that long, longer than 60-minute conversation with Freddie.
February of 2017, I think, is when the first one aired.
I might miss this by a little bit, Adam. I believe it was February 12th, 2017. So that came out at 9.
Was it really February 12th?
Oh, I don't know.
You sound so authoritative. That was Mr. Lincoln's birthday.
That's the trick, Freddie. Just act like you.
Oh, I see.
So if you missed the first appearance, go back and listen to that one after you finish this one, because you'll want to hear both.
Yep.
So, Freddie, this is part two. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for asking. I appreciate it. I enjoy hanging out with you guys.
As I listened back to the first one, I was making a list of things I wanted to talk to you about on this one. One of those things is, I think I'm right about this, your family were tobacco farmers.
Correct. I was raised helping my grandfathers in tobacco fields.
That is such an important part of North Carolina.
Well, yeah, and I grew up on Tobaccoville Road.
Mm.
So what was that like?
Well, I was out in the middle of the boonies. Both my grandparents raised tobacco. And so I was schooled in the whole hierarchy of going from hander as a kid to, if you will, the southern parallel to a bar mitzvah, when I was informed that I had come of age and I was to be now taken up with the men to prime tobacco.
Adam, one day you'll get to come up with the men.
So I was like, oh my gosh. And so I went up with the men to prime, pull the leaves from the tobacco. And then later on was to be a hanger, taking the stalks or the sticks of tobacco and putting them in the flue-cured barn so that they might turn from those green leathery leaves to that golden brown. I never smoked, but I'm going to tell you what. A pack house? It's one of the sweetest smelling things I have. I mean, it's ungodly. I used to watch my grandfather, who, by the way, was an illiterate white sharecropper.
Mm.
He could not read or write, could only sign his name because they taught him how. More times than not, it was an X. But I watched him pull one of those golden brown leaves one day in a tobacco barn, and he wrapped a portion of it around his finger, and he laid it into his mouth beside his gum. I was about 12, and I'm like, wow, that looked pretty cool. So I waited till everybody left the tobacco pack house. So I kind of wandered back. I followed my grandfather's example. I pulled a little leaf from the tobacco barn, golden brown, sweet smelling. And I knew, hey, I'm 12. There's no way I can handle my grandfather's apportionment.
Sure.
So I tore it half, and wrapped a little bit, stuck it in right there next to cheek and gum. They found me about 2 hours later in the woods babbling like an idiot.
I have a very similar story, but it's from college.
Yeah, and I got... You may have to redefine the word smoke, right? Oh, but I mean, yeah, you lay that stuff in on gum? Hey, baby, you're dialing direct. I mean, I took care of it. I never wanted to smoke a cigarette or take a chaw or what have you after that.
So, Freddie, and we may, I don't remember. I didn't do journalistic research like Adam did about what we talked about the first time. So how did you, first of all, where did you grow up? And secondly, how did you get from there to Carolina?
Okay. I grew up on Tobaccoville Road, mailing address, Route 2, Rural Hall, North Carolina. Not far from King, the home of Kenny Dennard.
Yep.
And just 2 miles to the east of Tobaccoville. So I grew up in the Bronze Triangle, if you will. You know, I missed that. So about 10 miles northwest of Winston-Salem, right off I-52 as you head toward Pilot Mountain and Mount Airy. How did I get to Carolina? When I was a junior and senior at North Forsyth High School in Winston-Salem, we were the Vikings. I was nominated for a Moorhead. I didn't win.
Hey, but you were nominated.
I was nominated.
If you got nominated, you were far ahead of anyone else in this room. Yeah. I can tell you that.
But, I mean, evidently, I needed more head to win. So I did not win. But I was under, because you're nominated, I was accepted. So I wound up coming to Carolina in the fall of 1970, when classes, the last year that classes began in September. Lived in Teague Dorm with Anson Dorrance and a bunch of my schoolmates from North Forsyth, and just had a wonderful experience here. So that's how I got here.
How does the family tree go from grandfather cannot read or write to Freddie, who I don't know for sure that you can read, but I know you can write,
and
nominated for a Moorhead scholarship in two generations?
It must be slim pickings at North Forsyth, but I don't know. I mean, I remember as a kid devouring books and history books and had a fascination for it. Then growing up with my father, who was a World War II veteran, and going to his Army reunions all over the place, Lancaster, Pennsylvania, Knoxville, Tennessee, Columbia, South Carolina, Beckley, West Virginia, I'd sit in the back of those rooms and listen as a 10, 11, 12-year-old kid to all these men and their experiences telling stories. Wow. And maybe some of that rubbed off. Maybe some of that allowed itself to permeate what little talent that I did have to be able to put a couple of sentences together. And certainly my love of history.
So we talked about this last time about you working with Coach Smith.
Yeah.
We recently had Dave Hanners on, and Coach Hanners told some great stories, but he told one that really stood out about Coach Smith's memory and how Dave Hanners was going through this old video, and Coach Smith walked in and knew exactly what game it was, knew what date it was, knew when it was or where it was played, and even to the point where he remembered the play that Coach Hanners was watching, and this was, what did Coach Hanners say, Adam? 27 years later.
Yeah.
I'd just be interested if you had any similar experiences where you saw this incredible recollection on display.
Well, maybe not as much as a span of 27 years, Jones, but I do remember that, you know, I kept stats for Coach Smith literally 4 or 5 seasons. I kept stats for him 1 year while I was teaching in my first year at Phillips, at that time junior high school. And I do recall that the end of the 70s and the early part of the 80s, I kind of lost touch a little bit. I wasn't around the program as much because I was an assistant coach at Phillips, and then I was an assistant coach with Ken Miller's Chapel Hill High School program, and we won the state championship in 1981, and had heard about some kid down in Wilmington who was really good but didn't make it out of their conference championship, and so we never came face-to-face with Michael Jordan and Wilmington Laney. But anyway, so about a 6 or 7 year period had gone by, and then I started doing statistics for NBC and a few other of the networks for college basketball, and I bumped into Coach Smith one day in Carmichael, and he stopped, and he asked me expressly about 5 or 6 specific things about my teaching, my courses, my coaching, that I was just absolutely stunned. How do you remember this? How do you follow this? I am convinced, because I used to remember Coach Fogler, Eddie Fogler, and all those assistants and staff in the basketball office spending hours going through multiple papers and snipping out, cutting out little articles that referred to a basketball player, to a manager, to even a statistician, and they would send them on to Coach Smith, who would then read them. And then after 1988, so we've now increased the span to a certain degree, I worked the Winter Olympics in Calgary, bumped into Coach Smith maybe 4 or 5 months after I returned. He asked me 3 or 4 specific questions about, well, how did it go up in Calgary? I understand you're in charge of opening and closing ceremonies. Tell me a little bit about Jim McKay. He had no reason to do that. I was a flunky statistician for him. I helped out with managerial duties on the road. Other than that, he had no reason, if you will, or sense of urgency to necessarily have to follow my career, but he did. And that's the amazing thing about him. Now, it wasn't 27 years, but I walked out of those two instances unbelievably impressed. How cruel that fate would throw him that curveball that robbed him of that thing that really, truly made him special and quite a treasure. Same thing for Woody. Mm-hmm. How ironic. So I can't match Dave. I'm sure Dave, one of his responsibilities at some point was sitting in the basketball office cutting out articles of former managers and basketball players and families and what have you that were connected to the basketball program. I can tell you for a fact, although I wasn't a brother or sister, if you will, in the family, maybe even a second cousin, he never forgot. And he never, I always felt a part. It's funny that we bring this up because last night I just did a 2-hour lecture on Coach Smith from 1961 to 1974. And one of the references that I did use was, you know, a coach's life. And I had forgotten that there in the leaf, he had signed it to Fred, a wonderful teacher and wonderful coach. He was amazing to be able to recall and to make certain that anybody that walked in that office and contributed in some small or great way, he never forgot.
What, as you prepared for your lecture on the early days, if you will, of Coach Smith, what did you learn that you didn't know? What did you relearn that you remembered was so impactful or that you found particularly interesting?
Well, I found that when Coach Smith, you know, got here, obviously, thanks to Reverend Robert Seymour and others, there was a real desire to have an African-American basketball player here at Carolina. And that was something that his father had made a priority back in Kansas. Hey, folks, prejudice is not regional. The South doesn't have the only dibs on that horrible mentality. In Kansas, back in the 30s and 40s, Coach Smith's dad literally risked the eligibility of his own team by playing an African-American player and withstanding the slurs and the slings of insult that came from fans, and eventually to the point that the Kansas High School Athletic Association said, you want to go to this particular playoff game? You might want to rethink this. So that was one thing. The fact, too, that he was so very, very close to his sister, Joan, which a lot of times we don't understand his family and what have you, or know completely about what his family was all about. And then, of course, in 1965, in January, you know, he was hanged in effigy. Mm-hmm. A lot of people don't know he was hanged twice. He was hanged after the absolute blowout to Wake Forest, in which Wake scored 107 points, which tied Indiana for the most points scored by an opponent against Carolina in program history at the time. And then, of course, 2 or 3 days later, Carolina goes over to Cameron, knocks off 8th-ranked Duke, comes back. Now, when the bus returns to Woolen, there's a tons of people standing out at Winston in front of Woolen. They celebrating, they're excited, they're even asking Coach Smith to make a comment or two, which he declined. And then a few days later, we play NC State in Woolen and lose 65-62, and he gets hanged in effigy again. What have you done for me lately?
Well, this worked last time. They beat Duke after we did this. May as well try it again.
I mean, the low point. And although he would always maintain that it wasn't necessarily the most traumatic thing in the world to him, it did bother him. And he had a meeting a few days later with the athletic director, Chuck Erickson, and assistant athletic director, Walter Rabb, who for many years was the UNC baseball coach. And although there was never the word firing mentioned, Erickson made it pretty clear. You got to get things going here. You know, we all know then there's the recruiting of Franklin Rusty Clark and Dick Grubar and Larry Miller and Gerald Tuttle and Joe Brown and Bill Bunting and, of course, the 67, 68, 69 years of three ACC regular season championships, three ACC tournament championships, three trips to the Final Fours. I always found it very interesting, and I made a point last night during the talk. At one point, they're hanging him in effigy, and at the end of his career, they're building structures and naming them after him, and even discussing the possibility that we have no Silent Sam, so let's put up Coach Smith.
Jones remembers all those guys except for Dick Grubar.
Seriously?
It's a long story.
Okay, all right, all right.
So I think if you haven't already figured this out, you need to attend Freddie's lectures. They're in conjunction with the GAA, but you don't have to be a GAA member.
No. And in fact, Adam and Jones have contributed mightily and made me look a lot better when they have come and shared their wisdom and expertise.
But they're not always just about basketball. They're about all sorts of things. And even if you see one and you think, I don't know if I'm really interested in that Civil War general, you will be interested by the time you leave there.
Thank you. Well, it's a story. History is a story. And that's why even in athletics and the broadcasting world, it's all a story. You guys know this. I mean, I'm sitting with two people who every broadcast and with every work, every book, you're telling stories. So that in history and that in athletics, when it all is said and done, we're talking about people and their triumphs and their failings and their overcoming crisis. It's human drama, and that's the best.
Speaking of talking about people, you mentioned Teague Dorm.
Yes.
When we had Anson Dorrance on the podcast, he mentioned the intramural sports dynasty that you and he were both part of. How did y'all do that, and what are some of your favorite stories from the Teague dynasty?
We had, well, when I got here in 1970, Anson was already here for a year or two, and I moved into a dorm unbeknownst that was just starting to get its arms and head around intramurals, kind of a rallying point for the some 212 residents that lived in Teague Dorm. Danny Newcomb was the architect of helping to build that program from the ground up as intramural manager, and then Jack Simmons and Alan Wilson, and the list goes on and on and on of managers who got teams together, made sure they got to the field. And then we had some pretty decent athletes. We were accused by the middle 70s of going out and recruiting at high school. But no, by the middle 70s, prospective students, when they were looking for a place to live, would be informed that, hey, if you're interested in intramurals, you know, you want to maybe look at Teague Dorm. Because we won 9 straight intramural championships. There were approximately 12 sports from, everything from wrestling and ping pong to, of course, football, basketball, softball.
I can't intramural wrestling. That would be something.
1 year to help the dorm, I wrestled.
Freddie in a singlet out there.
That was not good. I mean, I was weighing maybe, dripping wet, 131 pounds. I was the paperweight division. And I will never forget going in the bowels of Woolen for my wrestling match. And all I remember was about 3 moves that I had learned when I was in junior high school, thanks to Coach Smith. And then whatever I watched on wrestling on Saturday afternoon from Johnny Weaver and George Becker and the Bolos and what have you. And I won like 4 matches. I was like an animal. I'd walk out of there thinking, what did I just do? And so they held the championships in Carmichael. And here we go. I was, of course, weighing at about 125, 130. Of course, I was losing weight now because of all the... Yes.
All that tobacco you've been doing.
Right. They wanted, you know, the place was a pretty decent crowd. And I remember standing over there and, like, thinking, golly, Pete, I don't know what I'm doing, but, hey, four times has worked. They introduced me, and there was a little smattering of applause. Some of the Teague guys had come over. And then they introduced my opponent. From Ruffindorm, T. Gore. And I'm thinking, what? T. Gore? He's got to have a mask. Something's not right here. T-E-E-G-O-R-E. And so I walked out into the middle of the mat. They began the match. It's not 8 seconds, and I am a human pretzel. So I lost badly. But I made it to the finals.
Yeah.
I got the dorm points.
I don't see T. Gore doing any podcast interviews these days, Freddie.
He may be working with the Worldwide Federation of Wrestling now or something. T. Gore, what kind of name? What mother or father names their son? T-E-E. It's got to be a nickname.
One day, I hope this guy grows up to be an intramural wrestling champion.
Right.
Exactly. Hey, at that time, you got a little plaque, not some T-shirt. You got a plaque, man.
Was Anson as competitive as he is now?
Now, he says he doesn't remember this story, but boy, I sure do. I'm walking through Woolen, and they got all the ping pong tables set up. And Anson's playing some opponent, and I went, hey, can you take him? And he looked at me and said, oh, yeah, because I am a competitor. In Anson's head, he swaggered up to any intramural event, and he had in his mind already beaten the person across the net or on the floor that was going to be competing against him. And boy, it was communicated too. So if you got down to Anson Dorrance, go ahead and start writing your intramural obituary because you were going down. He was just such a fiery, incredible competitor. We played on several teams together. He pitched for our softball team 1 year. He was very good, fast pitch. And then he coached our soccer team 1 year. And I was so proud. I scored a goal. And again, it was like kind of like wrestling. Like, how in the name of the good Lord did I do that? And as I ran back to our sideline, Anson looked at me and went, well done. And then he looked at my friend Jack Simmons, who was huffing and puffing, and said, you're out of shape. And Jack was like, well, what do you expect me to do? I mean, I'm so sorry. And then he looked at me, no, you mean to be in shape like him? I was like, I got a compliment from Hanson. It's the only soccer goal I ever scored. But the intramural dynasty was something, Adam and Jones, that 212 guys of wannabe athletes developed a brotherhood and a family and a sense of community that carries over to right now, 2019. We still get together. We've donated thousands of dollars to the soccer facility. It's been something that has been a real, you know, it's not the NCAA, but for us it's been a source of pride, and it's been a bond that has connected us for forever. And we're so disappointed and heartbroken that Teague and Parker may be coming down in the near future to make way for campus expansion and building. You know, Woody lived in Parker.
Oh, I didn't know
Woody
that.
Woody Durham lived in Parker. So Scott College, Teague, Parker, and Avery Dorm, and Whitehead eventually. We were very blessed to have a universe within the greater universe of the university, and I never felt like this place was too big. I never felt like this place was such that I was swimming in, you know, lost and drifting in a sea of endless faces and people and cultures. Teague Parker, Avery and Whitehead, Scott College, Teague Dorm particularly, gave us that wonderful sense of belonging and something to take pride in.
Freddie, you have a long history in TV in a lot of different ways. We are in an interesting time in TV with the ACC network just now, 2 months old or whatever it is. Interested in your opinion on how that is playing out and where you think that future may go.
Well, the future is, that's going to be the future. I saw it in 1996 when I worked the Summer Olympics in Atlanta for NBC. Was I sent to Atlanta? No. They sent me to New York. Mm. I was in 30 Rock for a month in New York working the Summer Olympic Games in Atlanta. I kept telling them, look, does anybody else on your research staff know what a moon pie is? Does anybody know anything about Southern culture? For years, I may not speak Spanish fluently or French, but I speak Southern, and I may be able to help. And they're like, no, 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 we need you up here. Even then, I started noticing that if an event in the Summer Games did not meet their criteria for being able to sell for prime time, they were going to take the world feed, they were going to cut it up, edit it for the package that was going to be aired, and they would voice it over in New York, and they would have all their graphics and all their producing and direction from New York City. So I started thinking, whoa, wait a minute. So we're not even going to the sites now to do this? We're just kind of cutting and taking whatever we need and want? And that's the reason why I declined the opportunity to go to Nagano in 1998 Winter Olympics, because I didn't want to be a part. Lillehammer in France, 92 for France, 94 in Lillehammer. My goodness. To sit on top of those stories and to realize that the entire world was on the edge of their seats for what we were going to be broadcasting back in the States 5 hours later because of the time difference. Tonya Harding, Nancy Kerrigan, so many incredible stories. And particularly with Tonya and Nancy, you know, it was kind of full contact figure skating. So today, we've seen this coming in the last few years. Tens of thousands of dollars are saved by ESPN in particular when they don't have to park a truck out here.
Sure.
When they can just simply send someone to a control room at all the college campuses now, which ESPN did help in creating. Major sports like football and basketball, you're still going to get pretty much the same kind of quality of production, staffing, talent. But when you start getting into the Olympic sports, there's going to be a tremendous learning curve because those positions are being offered to a lot of folks who are at the schools in communication majors and broadcasting majors, and it's a great program. But it's going to take a while. I don't care how many labs you're in. I don't care how many times you've run graphics or you've directed or you've operated the bug or the slider or all these technical things. When you're doing live television, that's a whole nother animal. Mm-hmm. And there's going to be a learning curve there. It's going to take 2 or 3 years for people to start coming round to understanding and completing live television responsibilities given these sports. In part, yeah, it's a little, you know, I feel kind of like the old dinosaur. And then on top of that, then for all of us who in this area, and there is a Carolina mafia in broadcasting, tons of talented people who have won multiple Emmys and national awards for camera and stats and talent and production and direction have now had to adjust. Well, we have all this body of work, but how does that translate into people being hired out of Charlotte as opposed to Bristol, Connecticut? So there's been a little bit of concern. Does this carry over? Or are we at points in our careers with pay also on the line to be cut or pushed to the side so you can get someone else to fulfill the role who has a pulse, mm-hmm. but they don't cost as much? So yeah, there's a lot of concern. I mean, this evening I'm headed over to Duke. It's a control game. The control game, it's in the football stadium where the control booth is. It's just a different animal. As far as personnel, in some instances, the technology, and it has been a little bit of a concern. But I'm of the opinion, and I've always thought, if you're good enough, they're going to find you because they want you to be a part of the broadcast, regardless of what type of production that's going on.
You mentioned the Olympics.
Yeah.
I love the Olympics.
Oh, I did too. Yeah, I still do.
What was it like to be a part of the Olympics? During a time when those Olympics were not just a sporting event, they were a world event.
Correct.
And also, there were quite a few Tar Heels on the production and talent side with you.
Oh, yeah.
So what was that like?
Well, we always had an opportunity when we had downtime in our schedules, and that was not a lot to gather. We'd watch Dragan Mihailovic, Charles Kuralt, and I huddled in France in one part of the broadcast facility to listen to Armed Forces Radio, Duke, Carolina, when Montross gets the bow and the blood. You know,
I'm not sure he remembers that story. We'll have to double check.
Yeah, there were so many people. Not so much talent-wise, but, you know, cameras, graphics, and what have you. Now, that being said, Jim Lampley. Jim Lampley, Tar Heel born, Tar Heel bred. And so, yes, we would wink or keep up with whatever was going on in Carolina basketball. It was, Adam, it was fantastic. I mean, I'll never forget one day, we're getting ready to go over to the opening ceremony in Lillehammer. And so I am going over with the talent, and I go into this big white van, part of the carpool, to get us to the opening ceremony site. And as I sit in front of me is Neil Pielson, the president of CBS Sports. Seated to my right was Charles Kuralt. To my left was Ed Bradley of 60 Minutes. Behind me was Greg Gumbel and Andrea Joyce, who were the talent for the opening ceremony that I would be working with, and then the Norwegian interpreter that they gave to me so that when I was on site, I could communicate. Norwegian was not a part of my high school language.
North Forsyth didn't have Norwegian.
Although we were Vikings.
That's right.
But we didn't have. We had no Norwegian. I could do ja, skull. But I'm sitting there and I'm thinking, oh my goodness. Not bad for a skinny white boy from Tobaccoville Road. And I'll never forget, we go over to the opening ceremony. It was cold. The snow, when it hit my jacket, didn't melt. For every flake that hit my jacket, I could look and see every part of every crystal. I can tell you that there are no snowflakes that are similar because I could see. I was like, my goodness. I was drinking some milk just to kind of get me through the ceremony. And I remember opening it, sitting it down to open a little Norwegian breakfast snack that they eat. And I picked it up. I returned to the carton of milk. It was frozen. I was like, okay. There was also the time when I'm in the production booth, and this is before we go on air with the actual opening ceremony, and somebody comes over and says, hey, Freddie, can you entertain our next guest for the pre-opening ceremony show? Just talk to her. Just talk to her and, you know, spend a few, you know, till we get ready for her. I'm like, yeah, okay, sure. So I turn around, and there's Hillary Clinton, the first lady. And I'm like, okay, what am I going to do here? Well, as most people of that stature, I ask a couple of questions, and then she takes over and starts directing the questions, you know. And so we talked, and she was most pleasant. I'll always remember that, and most kind. And then after about 5 or 6 minutes, I said, oh, I think they're ready for you, Ms. Clinton. Good luck. Have fun. Thanks for joining us. And she turned to go sit at her place at the desk to be interviewed. And then I turned, and I just happened to see that there was a mirror. And I had my dad's Russian hat on from 1940s, the World War II thing. And I had forgotten to tie the ear flaps up. And then I looked into the mirror to realize that I had just talked to the First Lady of the United States of America, and I looked like a dadgum basset hound. These long ear flaps are flopping to both sides, and I said, oh, my gosh.
That's not the strangest thing she saw when she was First Lady. You're fine for it.
Well, I was hoping to make a little bit better impression as far as appearance.
Would you ever just ask Charles Kuralt to say things just so you could hear him sound awesome? And were you like, if you ever have to give a speech at the bicentennial, have you ever thought about it's not the well
no,
or
it's
the
not
bell.
The well or the bell. Right. What I think it is.
Yeah. Well, I remember we had just done the opening ceremony, and opening ceremonies were just, I mean, I would work a year. I'd work a year in research for a two-hour and a half show. And so I was literally exhausted. I mean, in Albertville, I went 67 hours with 3 hours of sleep and felt guilty about those three, just to get ready for Tim McCarver and Paul Lazon to make sure they were up to snuff and feeling comfortable and good. All right, so in Lillehammer, we get through with the opening ceremony, and I'm sitting at my desk in the broadcast center, and I'm fried. Whoa. And then I hear or sense someone standing in front of my desk, and up through locked fingers I looked, and all I can see is a bay window of a belly. And then I hear the voice. Dragan tells me that you might have a little bit of time maybe to help me with a couple of stories. And I'm like, Charles, whatever you need, you just let me know. And so I helped him with a couple of pieces. One was on losing. Speaking of the Olympics, all anybody wants to talk about are gold, silver, bronze, but nobody dwells on the losers unless you're Eddie the Eagle in Calgary. But he did a piece there, and then I helped him with another story. I went around one day making a tape, talking to everybody from Neil Pulson to Dragan Mihaljevic, who was there, part of the staff, as a producer, other people, anybody and everybody, Charles, for my high school class, and I sent the cassette back. That's one of my treasured pieces to have Charles just kind of muse aloud. And it's the voice, you're Adam. He was a wordsmith. He would take something that I know for me, I would try to put in 15, 20 words, and he could convey it more clearly in 8, in 10, and then the delivery. And if you think about it, all those guys from CBS, Walter Cronkite, that's the way it was October the 16th, 1968. They all had that kind of stentorian staccato style. Edward R. Murrow had a little bit of that stuff. But it was not only the words, it was how they delivered it. So no, I never really truly asked Charles, but I had enough occasion with him to just savor and to bathe myself in that wonderful lilt and delivery.
Freddie, you did Tar Heel Sports Network radio for a couple years for football, right?
Yeah, I am a footnote. I am a trivia question. Who was the play-by-play analyst, or who was the analyst for the Tar Heel Sports Network before Mick Mixon?
Right. So you were there for the 1-10 back-to-back seasons,
correct?
Right? What was that experience like? And by that I mean trying to be on the radio covering a team that was clearly not very good at that point in time, and I'd be interested in early or late 1980s Mac Brown and what he was like.
There was no question. Well, see, you know, Coach Crum. I loved him, but Coach Crum, and we're talking about Dick Crum, inherited a recruiting class and a group of athletes from his reign here, his tenure, and rode that horse, you know, 4 bowl games, 4 bowl wins. And then it started to tell a little bit when Coach Crum started going after the kids that weren't picked up by Penn State, that weren't picked up by Ohio State. And all of a sudden we started realizing that we didn't have a whole lot of North Carolina kids, and we were getting beat to death by in-state schools getting kids. Does this sound anything familiar? So when things kind of went sour and Coach Crum's top floor collapsed, it pancaked because there was nobody around to really go, hey, you made your own bed, sleep in it. Bang, 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 bang. All right, so Mac comes in, and the well is dry. But even during the 1-10s, and you guys can relate, when things are, you know, you're getting your head bashed in by an opponent, it's hard. It's hard to stay maintained or stay up and to communicate in such a fashion that, you know, oh yeah, we're down 56-0, but we got to still make this thing entertaining. And the professional challenge to be complete, to be thorough, to be objective, and to do it the way it needs to be done. But there was something that we knew all along when Mac got to town. Mac Brown gets it. He understands what it is to be head coach. He understands to surround himself with talent on his staff. He understands that it's not just the football team, his staff, and himself that paints a picture in Keenan Stadium on Saturday. There's a band. There are students. There's the media. There are the fans that are coming. You tell me how many head coaches go out to Navy Field and talks to the band on a Friday afternoon and lets them know how important they are to presenting a package to enhance a fan's experience for a home football game. Mac gets it. So, yes, I'll never forget after we had one victory, his first, I took the time to write my observations when I was standing in the booth with Woody and the staff and the network. And all I remember is the field was flooded by Carolina players. And from the midst of this tight blue huddle, Mac was lifted up to the players' shoulders. It was almost like a flower, if you will, emerging from this sea of blue. And it left such an incredible impression on me. I wrote him just a little note. How proud, how excited. The visual that left me with this thing that I can still relate to you in 2019. And he called me into his office to thank me. He didn't have to do that. He doesn't have to do that. Last winter, I ran into some of the Carolina football players. Mac had been in town maybe 2 or 3 months. I just said, hey, what do you think? To a man, every one of them noticed this incredible change in the entire atmosphere, in the entire, if you will, culture that was going on over there in the football office. Everybody was pumped up and excited about what was coming. Mac gets it, and I'm telling you, you guys are going to have a lot of chances in the next few years to talk about a lot of wonderful, exciting things in Carolina blue and white.
All right, I have one more. You have had the opportunity to be courtside, sideline, whatever, for some great Carolina stuff, some great ACC stuff. If you had to give us two of the best that you've seen.
Wow.
Individuals, not moments. Who are the two best individuals that you've seen perform on the ACC stage?
Wow. Jones, it's almost impossible. I have been so blessed to have had so many opportunities to be a part. I mean, starting with Coach Smith, 1974. Starting with radio in 1978. And starting with television in 1981-82. Oh, there's Harrison Barnes, 40 points against Clemson. Phil Ford in his final game, scoring a career high against Duke, the same Duke team that went on to advance to the national championship game before losing. Walter, 8 points in 17 seconds, and Walter Davis's shot. I mean, I have been so blessed to watch so many people and to stand off to the side and just kind of be Lynn Bias, the first time he came to the Smith Center, handed the Heels their first home loss. Maryland and Duke, not necessarily individual, but it was at a time when Andy Katz had proclaimed that the new rivalry for Duke was Maryland. What? But that was it at the moment. 25 lead changes in the first half. That's nuts.
Yep.
So in a way, I'm dodging your question because I'm kind of humbled and lost to try to figure out if there was one that I just walked away from and thought, there's just too many. There's just too many. I've been so very blessed to have been a part of wonderful opportunities like that. And I'm sure I've already left on the table so many moments and so many individuals. But you think about it. All three of us. How lucky we are. Are you kidding me? I don't ever want to take advantage of the fact that on a game night, we're seated courtside and we're watching some of the best basketball being coached by some of the best basketball staffs and being, if you will, the orchestra, those players on the bench and out on the floor. We get to do that all the time. As a kid, I had two trash cans on the end, each end of my second floor part of the house. And I would dribble a tennis ball back and forth and do the play-by-play of Clemson and Carolina and Duke in the 60s. And it was my life. If I had known that I would have the opportunity to be a part of something that, whether we want to think about it or not, they're going to be talking about 40 and 50 and 60 and 70, 80 years down the road. Golly, Pete, how fun it is to think that we're not sitting on the bank. We're swimming in the river, if you will. And it's good stuff, and we are very blessed to have that opportunity.
Hey guys, it's Jones. Just a couple of things before we continue with the podcast. Number one, as we talked about, Adam and I were recording our portion of the show a little earlier than normal due to Adam's travel with basketball for the Bahamas tournament starting on Wednesday. And so we recorded before knowing the result of a couple of important events for Carolina Athletics on Sunday. So number one, what up? To the field hockey program, their second consecutive undefeated season, their second consecutive national championship, their eighth national title overall. We hope to have some more coverage of that coming up next week when we get back into our regularly scheduled podcast. So again, an enormous congratulations to Coach Shelton and her team for bringing home yet another national title. Again, their eighth and the 51st team national title for Carolina Athletics. Also, big congratulations to Carolina women's soccer program. They have advanced to the round of 8 in the NCAA tournament. They did that by defeating Michigan on Sunday afternoon after beating Colorado earlier in the weekend. Carolina's next action now on the women's soccer side of things is at home. It is against Southern California this Friday. That's November 29th. At 6 o'clock, if you're in the area and interested in tickets, you may want to jump on those early. The game against Colorado on Friday was sold out. The game on Sunday was almost. It was really close to a sellout. So, again, that is Friday, 6 o'clock, Carolina and Southern Cal in Chapel Hill at Dorrance Stadium, or Dorrance Field there in Chapel Hill, for the right to go to the Final Four. So again, congratulations to the women's soccer program for that as well. Now, normally we like to be able to give you some updates on what Coach Brown talked about on Monday during his press availability. Again, due to our recording schedule this week, we didn't do that. So what we'll do is we're going to go to the first, just the opening comment and maybe a question or two that Coach Brown took on Monday in his media availability. Let you hear that. Then we'll roll right back in to the rest of the show here on the Carolina Insider. Also, have a wonderful Thanksgiving. Thanks so much for listening today. And let's get to Coach Brown, then the rest of the show. And hope you're enjoying yourself here on the Carolina Insider.
Good morning. First, want to wish everybody a happy Thanksgiving week. It's always fun this time of the year, even when I was doing TV, because all the rival games are this weekend. And it's just a fun weekend of college football, and starting Thursday and then all day Friday and all day Saturday. So it doesn't get better than this week for college football. I was really happy for our seniors on Saturday afternoon. We challenged the entire team to play for the seniors and play to a standard. And it was obviously a lesser team than us, and we a lot of times you go out there and stand around against those teams, and our guys didn't. They started the first play of the game, forcing a turnover. We scored immediately, dominated the first half completely. I wish we had not had the holding call on the 75-yard touchdown pass by Sam, because that was such a great play. that it was called back. But really, really excited for the game. Our guys had fun. They were ready to play. When you show that you have less selfishness, that helps your team. And they were really excited when guys were making plays that hadn't made as many plays in the past. So they were excited about Sam's record. They were excited about Jake Vargas catching a touchdown pass. They were excited about young guys covering kickoffs that hadn't done that before and hitting somebody. And so it was a real fun day for our players. I don't think I've ever seen a team have that much fun, especially against a team that they were supposed to beat and knew they were supposed to beat and did beat. So they played to the standard of what we want to play each week, and that was fun to watch them do that. I was pleased that it was a sellout. We're only one of eight teams that had a sellout. I was disappointed not many more people came, and our fans need to do better than that. Rain Day, Mercer, we're going to start moving if we play an FCS game, we're going to move it up to the front of the season so it won't be at the end. But we could have done better with our fan base this weekend. Played a bunch of guys and came out healthy, I think. Just about everybody that was eligible played. Our white team, our second teams as such, played a whole lot. In fact, it was so good to get so many of those defensive guys in the first half. And then they played the entire second half. We played very few starters the second half. It was good to get Vincent Amendola some throws and still try to keep the score down. We didn't want to score more than we'd scored, but we wanted to get him some work so it better prepares him. This week is fun because it's the last week of the season, and we've still got a possible bowl game out there, and you're playing a rival in NC State, and we haven't done very well against them, like the Duke game. They've dominated this series as of late, so it's time for us to step up and play better. We've got to, like against Duke, we've got to do our part in this rival, and we haven't done that the last four of the last 5 years. And you've got bowl eligibility at the end for us, and that's something that these guys want to do. A lot of our team hadn't been to a bowl, so it's a great week for us, a fun week, a challenging week that we will get to play our rival in Raleigh on the road and at the same time have a bowl game at the end if we do our job. Questions?
When you were head coach here, the Duke game was the last game. Now it's kind of become State, but the last decade or so. Is this the way you think it should be, closing with State?
I grew up with Duke being the last game here. That was 10 years, so that's what I thought. And since the Carolina-Duke basketball game is such a huge rivalry nationally, I always thought that game should be there. But we have two rivals, and that's been documented for years. Wake Forest used to be in that group, and now that they're on the other side of the conference, the Atlantic, and you don't play them very often, it didn't feel like it, and our players didn't play like it. So I feel like now that the two rival games are State and Duke, and it doesn't matter where you put them, they're still very important. That rival games are important to your fans. And when something's important to your fans and your supporters, it becomes really important to you. Because they do not want to go to work on Monday and have Duke coworkers or State coworkers laughing at them about winning a game. I've learned that through many, many years as a head coach. So these games are very important. And the players usually get along. They know each other, and they've played against each other in high school. Fans don't. Bragging rights are really, really important to people, and that's what makes a rival game so special.
To be in the position that you all are in to play for a bowl game, and considering where the program was before, what does that mean to you?
Jonathan, it's a good feeling that it's funny. It's been such an up and down year. It's a great feeling that we're in this position with a chance to go to a bowl. It's also been disappointing that we've had so many opportunities against a Virginia Tech who will play for the Coastal against Virginia this weekend, against Virginia, against Pittsburgh. We've had those opportunities, and the next step of our program, I thought, was to play to a standard last weekend, and we did that because I wasn't sure we would. I thought they might go out there and stand around, and that's why I showed them pictures of last year's Western Carolina game where we didn't play very well early for sure. And now the next step is that we have to win these games. that are close. We've won some, but we've lost more than we've won, and that's the disappointing thing. But we really need to finish well. And I think the guys, just watching them yesterday and watching them practice yesterday afternoon, I think they're ready for this challenge.
What did you feel was most important when you first got to the program and you assessed why they were struggling? What did you feel was most important to change?
I thought the most important thing is that they needed to believe again. The fan base didn't believe. The players, they didn't believe they could win. They're just so, when you get that, there's a lot of negativity. There's a lot of selfishness. It becomes about you when it's not about team. There becomes a lack of discipline when they don't think they're going to win. So why do I need to do this and why do I need to do that? Doesn't matter anyway. So it's a process of pulling everything back together, and then to make it work, you have to win. And we've won enough that the players have bought in now and they understand what it takes to win. And that gives us a better chance this weekend.
A lot of coaches try to kind of shy away from rivalries and say they're just another game, but have you always embraced them in the way that you say they are important?
Absolutely. I think they're fun. They're what you play for. And it's when it's fun, that much fun for your fan base, it's that much fun for you. And I had a friend at Texas that we lost a game to one of our rivals that he didn't like, and he had to work with those people on Monday. He got on a plane and went to Cabo for a week, so he wouldn't have to see them. I said, they're still going to be here when you get back. And when you lose to a rival, you lose for the year. Some of the other games, you go to the next game. Rivals last all year. So that you got to live with it. You got to live with your friends and your neighbors, and that's why it needs to be. You need to be the one walking into work on Monday with a smile.
Appreciate Freddie's time. Always great to talk with him. Adam, you've done a little research. I was impressed you were able to do it while we were doing the Freddie interview. And you can tell folks if they haven't heard the first edition of our, because I'm sure you're leaving that going, I could listen to that man talk forever. Well, guess what? We have like an hour plus long interview with him the first time he was on the pod. And you know the date, Adam.
This is back when the pod went over an hour. We were all surprised. Like, what? This pod was an hour and 23 minutes? How would we ever do something longer than that? February 3rd, 2017 is Freddie Kiger 1.0. And remember, no second pod this week. So on Friday, when you're sitting there going, man, I sure wish there was a pod, you can go back and listen to Freddie 1.0.
February 3rd, 2017. That was only like 6 months into the pod. If that. I don't even think it was that. Like 4 months into the pod. 4 months, 5 seconds, it all goes by about the same amount of time, Adam. And did you know that texting while driving takes your eyes off the road for an average of 5 seconds? Did you know that, Adam?
I did.
Highway speeds, that's like driving the length of an entire football field with your eyes closed. Trusted Choice, independent insurance agents of North Carolina. Want you to stay safe behind the wheel. No need to text and drive. Go to trustedchoice.com/goheels. Find an independent insurance agent near you to learn more. No 5 second challenge this week. Man, you have to wait till December. Adam, this is our last pod of November. Can you believe it?
Next time, the Pod World headquarters will be all decorated for Christmas.
It is. Let me just say, it's nice to be in Pod World headquarters.
Oh, I agree.
Okay, Adam, anything else that we need to take care of? Are there a couple emails or tweets that we wanted to get to, I believe?
What's on the top of Adam's list? Brought to you by Top of the Hill, where Tar Heels come to celebrate.
Yeah, just a couple quick things before we send you off on the rest of your holiday Thanksgiving week. Good job, James Allen. He tweeted at us that he was the one who hit the 20,000 water bottle mark.
Yeah.
At perhaps his office, maybe. But that was big time to hit the big 20,000. That's a big number.
Yeah. I got, even though I figured since James sent it to us and it said 19,999, it was getting pretty late in the pour. I was getting a little concerned.
The next time you hit a big water bottle number, you need to put the Titanic music behind it. As it crosses over, the music swells.
I like your thought, Adam. Can I just say, you may be wanting to address this. We had a couple people who sent us tweets or emails about their theory that Christian Laettner purposely tried to run over the Tar Heels on his recruiting visit. And
what,
Jeff,
what up, Christy Kent?
In Jeff Denny's story. I think it's hilarious that people dislike Christian Laettner so much that their first reaction was, I bet he tried to do that on purpose. Like, look, I don't know Christian Laettner personally, and I feel the same way you do as his about his tenure at Duke. It's hard for me to take that next step to he was he was trying to purposely injure slash something worse than injure people on purpose with a car.
Well, not I don't think 17-year-old Christian Laettner would have done that. He wasn't fully formed Christian Laettner at that time. It's like Kylo Ren. Like, there was still, I see the good in you.
What about, like, February 1991 Christian Laettner?
That's a little more questionable. I think then you've got more evidence that, that it might be possible. But I think recruiting visit Christian Laettner, who hasn't fully been indoctrinated, I'm not sure I'm willing to go that far. But Christy Kent did express that that feeling. Also, Sean Patrizzi tweeted at us about how if the Tar Heels did trade Christian Laettner for Eric Montross, that's one of the greatest trades in Carolina basketball history.
You're saying not if they traded. You're saying getting Eric and not getting...
Instead of getting Christian Laettner, because we talked about the butterfly effect.
Right.
I thought about that some more when I was listening back to the pod. That's got to be one of the all-time possible ramifications of one swing event in Carolina basketball history. Because, and I think Sean Patrizzi said this, Christian Laettner was Duke. Everything about him was Duke. If he comes to Carolina, is Carolina Duke? Do I think slapping the floor is cool?
Adam, I've never told you this before and meant it until now. You shut your mouth, Adam.
I think that's one of the all-time swing events. I can't think of a bigger one than that one. Chris Miller sent us a very impressive Photoshop. I think the kids call it edit of Shaq with a quadruple shrimp cocktail. And Chris was giving him the arms crossed. It had a little bit of everything.
I showed this picture to my son. He thought it was actually Shaq. He was very confused why Shaq was holding four shrimp cocktails and a UNC towel.
Why would he not? Because you can order as many shrimp cocktails as you want, as we now know.
When you're Shaq,
yeah,
you certainly can.
Yeah. Now, of course, that came out in the Jeff Denny interview. What a timely picture. Dusty Tompkins sent us on Instagram. I had not ever seen this picture.
No, I hadn't seen it before either.
Of, I think there were five Tar Heels in the picture in the locker room in Austin, Texas, post-Oklahoma game, and they were given the hook 'em horn sign, as Jeff Denny said they did.
Yep.
So Jeff Denny was telling the truth. Nice grab there by Dusty Tompkins. Let's see. Okay. Now, this is a very important link. That will, this is important for your holidays. This is in Port St. Lucie, Florida. CNN, so you know it's factual. Ann Sable's cul-de-sac in Port St. Lucie, Florida is fairly quiet. Well, it was. Until a dog hopped in its owner's running car, kicked it in reverse, drove in circles for an hour.
I didn't see that.
And smashed a neighbor's mailbox before safely exiting the vehicle without so much as a scratch. Sable didn't know who was behind the wheel when she first spotted the car, whirling around the block like an inept student driver might. At first I thought I saw somebody backing up, but they kept going and I'm like, okay, what are they doing? She told CNN. Oh, hold on, I lost my link. Okay, there. Then the cops came, and then the fire department. Authorities watched from a distance as the driving dog did donuts. Finally, the vehicle hit a mailbox and some garbage cans, then slowed down. Port St. Lucie police opened the door, and Sable watched as a large black Labrador retriever hopped out of the driver's seat. She remembered thinking, okay, this is turning weird. It turns out that
Sable and I would be on the same wavelength.
The dog's owner, who asked to remain anonymous, had left his car running in the street when the dog changed gears.
Can't fault the dog owner on this one, Adam. if you have to leave the car running because you got to run in and get something, I got to tell you, the last thing on my mind is that the dog would take the car for a drive.
For an hour doing donuts in right. the street.
Yeah. It's easy in hindsight, I think, to call out the owner. Let's be honest. None of us would anticipate this one happening.
Sable, for one, was impressed. She said they should give that thing a license.
Just a feel-good holiday story, Adam. Nobody was hurt except for that mailbox.
The dog's owner has promised to fix the mailbox.
Oh, that's good. Thanks for that update.
Yep.
That reminds me of something. I don't know why the donuts and the dog made me think about something I heard Jay Bateman say one time. You know how they're always they're talking about cornerbacks have to have a short memory? He said he calls it a goldfish memory because a goldfish always swims in a circle. And he goes, I want my DBs to be like, hey, look at that castle. Hey, look at that castle. Hey, look at that castle. I thought that was funny. Okay, just a couple more things in our interaction with wonderful Tar Heel fans. We received a note from Troy Rayner because we saw somebody named Chris Harris was talking about first down lasers again, which most people on the internet now know that we have trademarked first down lasers.
Yeah, we invented that. You're welcome to talk about it as long as you pay us the standard royalty.
Troy Rayner said there is a Coke spot that we run during the games that someone yells the word lasers in. He said we should just insert that every time we talk about it, and we might get sued, but it would be totally worth it.
Our good friends at Coca-Cola wouldn't do that.
Some of our finest corporate buddies.
They'd probably give us a sturdy pat on the back.
Yeah, and a ice cold Coca-Cola.
Celebrating the 2005 national champions.
Tim Harrison said that he was out at a local restaurant in Point Pleasant, New Jersey. And who did he run into? Just a couple Tar Heel legends, Adam. J.R. Reed and King Rice. He said they could not have been nicer. Snapped a photo with Tim as well. Pretty cool.
Hopefully Tim didn't get up and go to the bathroom and leave his fork on the table.
Yeah, that's right. It's going to be blazing hot if you do. We know that for a fact. Last thing. We've had several people reach out and ask about Lenny Rosenbluth, Tar Heel great. Lenny normally he goes to every home game at the Smith Center. He has not been at the Smith Center this year, despite Carolina playing three of its first four games. And folks have reached out to us just to ask if Lenny's doing okay, if something's going on, because they're concerned that they haven't seen him and they're used to seeing him there.
And yes, I think you will see him at the Smith Center this year. He had a couple of health challenges this summer. Nothing that you need to put on your list of worries or anything. Just the kind of thing that you have to go through and get through and takes a while to recover from. But we have spoken to him recently and his lovely wife, Diane, and their firm plans are they want to be back in that Smith Center. If not for the Ohio State game, then sometime shortly after that. But they love it when Tar Heel fans are thinking about them and saying hello to them at the games or whatever. So certainly they appreciate that and look forward to seeing you soon over there where you're used to seeing them near the Tar Heel bench.
All right, before we get out of here, fire up your tractor and let me remind you. That there's no need to let your outside chores or projects cause you to miss any of the Tar Heel action this year. Let LS Tractor help make short work of those for you. From normal yard maintenance to larger projects, LS Tractor has the machine for you. Visit lstractor.com to see the difference. LS Tractor, what is it about for you? Adam, anything else before we say goodbye for the Thanksgiving break and a busy Tar Heel stretch?
It'll be a long time till we pot again.
Yes, we won't be with you for a whole nother week, but think of all the stuff we'll be able to talk about. We'll have the Heels in Atlantis. We have the game against NC State football-wise. We'll know if the Tar Heels are going to the postseason. We will have, I think we'll have all ACC football at that point or very close to it. I can give you the breaking news of my votes because no big deal. I vote. Adam doesn't. I don't know if you know that.
Do you think Sam Howell's going to get first-team quarterback over Trevor Lawrence?
I think he's going to be really close. If I had to get, and I'm not saying this is how I'm going to vote.
Don't reveal your vote early.
If I had to guess, I think Lawrence is going to get first team. I think Sam's going to get second team. And I think Newman or Perkins will get third team. Newman from Wake, but he has not had as good a last couple games, and he's been injured, whereas Perkins is kind of on the ascension quarterback-wise here in the last few weeks. I think the three teams will be decided. Of those four guys, three of them will make up the three quarterbacks. Lawrence, Howell, Newman, Jamie Newman from Wake, and Bryce Perkins from Virginia. I think some combination of those four, three of them will be on the teams. I think he's slam dunk rookie of the year.
Yes. Well, and if Howell doesn't get first team, a lot of people are going to be upset because his numbers are the best of any of those people you named. But there's more to it than that.
Well, and I will say they have evened it out now where just because there's more media members that cover team X or Y, that doesn't matter anymore. As we've discussed, it is the coach and then two media members, one of which is your radio representative that votes for each school. Or wait. Two media members, the radio guy, and then the head coach. So each school gets four total votes representatives who vote. So we'll see.
Wouldn't be entirely bad if Sam Howell didn't get first team and then could spend the offseason thinking,
think about how
I'll show you guys,
yeah,
Jones, who didn't vote for me for first team.
Don't you worry, Sam Howell. I'm in your corner, champ.
Sam Howell really seems like the kind of guy who is completely obsessed with all ACC voting procedures.
But so we'll have all of that to talk about. Plus, we're going to have a good guest as well. So, a lot to do. Plus, we can preview Ohio State. So we know we're going to be gone for a week. We want you to have a wonderful Thanksgiving. You cheer hard for the Tar Heels. And we look forward to seeing you after that. Adam, anything else?
No.
Have a great Thanksgiving. I would prefer if you wore that jaunty sweater vest that you're currently wearing during Thanksgiving.
It'll be too hot where I am for Thanksgiving, unless I wear it with no sleeves.
All right. For now, we will let Freddie Kiger, who has joined now a growing list of people who use a secondary language, on his See You Later Big Grits. And the RZA, of course, to get us out of here on the latest edition of the Carolina Insider.
This is Freddie Kiger, and adios, grande grits.
When I was small, we had nothing at all. We used to eat grits for dinner.
Pound box of sugar and a stick of margarine. A hot pot of grits kept my family from starving. Steamy hot meal served less than 5 minutes. Big silver pot boiling water salt in it. House full of brothers and sisters, the pot's missing. Pilgrim on a box on the stove in the kitchen.
When I was small, we had nothing at all. We used to eat.
See you later, Big Grit.
The preceding has been a Learfield IMG College presentation of the Tar Heel Sports Network.